And I'm sure that, you know, the immigrants would complain about the way the Indians smelled. I'm sure to the Indians, the whites really were rank. And they were. By the time you would have gotten to the easy part, once you gotten over the easy part of the trail and had reached, say, Utah or Idaho, you would be absolutely sunburned, mosquito bitten, calluses had replaced the bottoms of your feet. It was so immensely physically challenging that it's hard to think of any equivalent experience in modern life. But it was an exceptionally difficult experience. And one of my favorite observations from James Clyman, the great mountaineer, is if he meets a bunch of people going west in 1846, and he says, if any of these people had any idea of what was facing them, they never would have come out here. Never. And it's true. They wouldn't.
I also like the image of these wagons as, I guess my image is these bleached white covered wagons, but they painted them. They could be colorful. There was a colorful spectacle in some of these wagon trains.
One train's known as the Blue Train because they painted everything blue. And the canvas, or Onisberg, is one of the popular terms for it, was not inherently waterproof. You had to prime it, put linseed oil on it, or paint it. Painting, some people say painting was a good thing to keep the water off. Some people said don't paint your wagon. But the colors, they're American vehicles. They're like cars. Yeah. They're going to customize them. And, of course, you could use the opportunity to put your slogan, California, Oregon, Montana, or bust, wherever it was. Yeah. And many more of them have funnier, root hog or die. And, of course, then if you were defeated by the trail, you could write busted by darn on it.
Right. There's a whole section you write about how the wagons worked themselves. I mean, was it good technology? Were they effective?
Of course. It worked.
Yeah.
And they were simple.
Yeah.
Again, the mythology represents these big Conestoga wagons often. And they were some boat wagons, which are the curved bottom wagons, which were designed to haul barrels and trade and customized specifically in the West for the Santa Fe trade. Some of them came out. But most of them were boxes on two simple running gears, a front axle and a back axle. No brakes, very little iron to reinforce the most critical parts, capable of breaking at any time, but easily fixed in one fashion or another. And I spent a lot of – that was maybe the hardest part of the book to write, was trying to figure out in my own head how to explain how a wagon worked, to understand how it worked myself, and to explain it in a clear enough and entertaining enough fashion to keep a reader's attention. And it's probably overkill. But, again, it's important.
Yeah.
If you want to know how – people did this, you need to understand what they're talking about when they talk about the dozen different parts of a wheel that can fall apart or break. And so I tried to be as entertaining as possible, but to give people everything you could want to know and more about the Overland Trail.
There's this idea that we have that these people were good at cooperating with each other, which I'm sure is, you say, is on one hand true. It's what got them out here. It's what made them successful. But it was also, this could break down a lot. And you've talked about the fact that it was the source of a lot of disasters, that they weren't always cooperating as a people.
There have been studies done on group participation, and ships are a good example. And they say almost any group of people can get along for about 30 days. And then the conflict starts.
Yeah.
Any confined group or group in a difficult situation is inevitably going to have conflict. There is a big debate that's gone on among historians for a long time over whether the West was an individual exercise or a cooperative exercise.
Yeah.
It was, of course, both.
Right.
But we're Americans, and these were Americans, and they've got so many different conflicts, and the stakes are so high that often cooperation would be overwhelmed by petty conflicts, hunger, competition. Ultimately, though, the most successful of the groups, and certainly the Mormons are a great example of the power of cooperation, had to come down to some kind of mutual understanding that you were depending on each other. And you had, of course, intense friendships and bitter hatreds that came out of all this.
Will Bagley is with us. His book, So Rugged and Mountainous, Blazing the Trails to Oregon and California. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Will Bagley. He's talking about the latest in his quest to chronicle the westward migration of American settlers. His latest book tells the story of the overland trails that brought more than 500,000 Americans to the far west of Oregon and California. It's a story of families and fortune tellers and about the effect of all of this on the native people who for centuries had already been calling the West home. The book is called So Rugged and Mountainous, Blazing the Trails to Oregon and California. So the other thing we need to say is that the book is packed with stories. And I want to ask you, do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite story, favorite character?
I do. And it's partly because it was a detective story. And to do the setup in 1846, the trains start out essentially organized into three or four very big groups. There are about 1,500 people that go west that year. And they break down into smaller groups, and they pass through Fort Laramie. And when they get to Fort Laramie, and we only have one source that provides a lot of detail on this, the immigrants have a woman with them who is a mother and is known as the Skinny Widow. And they believe that she's a loose woman and that she has large sexual appetites and that she's a tramp. And they decide that they're going to abandon her at Fort Laramie. Francis Parkman, who writes the great classic, The Oregon Trail, even comments on what dire straits this poor woman's going to be left in. She says, there's nothing out here but savages. And how a white woman's going to make it, I have not the slightest idea. But, and Heinrich Lienhardt, who was a very charming young Swiss immigrant and a brilliant journalist and writer, describes her and another young woman. And you can sense this ingrained misogyny that he feels immensely threatened by these single women. And I used that section to talk about how women, their role in this huge undertaking. And
they were subjugated, women.
Oh, they were, absolutely. Women have always had considerable social power in any situation. But in terms of status, they did what they were told, or they'd be beaten for it. It's almost shocking coming from our perspective, modern perspectives, to see how few rights women had. Whatever rights they had, they asserted by themselves and by the power of their personalities. But again, they play an essential role in this whole experience. And they are a big part of the political transformation because when the fur traders see Narcissa Whitman and Eliza Spaulding at rendezvous in 1836, they all go, the jig is up. White women in the Rockies? And when John McLaughlin, who's the Hudson's Bay chief at Fort Vancouver finds that two American women have made it over the trail in one season, he can see the writing on the wall. But a single woman who was independent and able to negotiate difficult situations on her own was a threat. And a man at Fort Laramie tells the story that he wanted to let her accompany his family. And the guy's wife said, "It's no. She's not coming with us." And this woman winds up stranded at Fort Laramie. And the question had always been, well, what happens to her?
Yeah.
And that's the fun part of the detective work was I figured it out. And Dale Morgan hinted that he knew who this woman was. And he said, I believe she married...